Love that question so much. God, Tim for U.S. as a president. So,
bumper stickers are being made.
I'll run your campaign.
Go with the blues! Go marching in! Go with the blues! Go marching in!
You're listening to the You're Smarter Than Us podcast, Asheville's premier soccer podcast.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of You're Smarter Than Us. Extremely excited to be here at the home pub of the South Slope Blues, Old London Road. I've got with me a special guest today, Megan Burke. How are you, Megan?
I'm good. Thanks so much for having me, Tim.
Absolutely. So, Megan, last summer, before the season kicked off, we were able to talk and chat a little bit about your role with Asheville City Women and everything we were doing here in town. But, you know, we also lightly touched upon your role as the counsel for the NWSL Players Association. And at that time, it wasn't even a real association. Since then, have you guys formed a little bit more of an official organization?
It's funny, you're dating my memory. I was like, really? Gosh, like that both feels so long ago and so recent, you know? It's funny what happens when you have kids in the interim. So it is, I can't even remember the date at this point because my sense of time is so off these days, but the league voluntarily recognized the Players Association as the exclusive bargaining representative of NWSL players. There's some complicated language around what constitutes NWSL players, just because you've got the U.S. Women's National Team players who, as a condition of their contract with USSF, play in NWSL.
We'll get to that shortly.
And blah, 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 blah. I'm doing the lawyer thing already. Let me drink up.
What was the benefit of being officially recognized? Yeah. What were maybe a few of the essential things you kind of were hitting out or that you're looking at with the next CBA?
Yeah, so... So we did something a little unconventional that's probably worth explaining, because usually when workers form a union, the next move is to negotiate a collective bargaining agreement. I'll call it a CBA for short. And so it was. I think it actually kind of threw them off that that's not what we wanted to do. Our primary objective was to, first of all, get organized. Internally, we needed to constitute our bargaining unit. We needed to establish governance. We needed to establish bylaws and committees and whatnot. And I mean, I have to pause here and just say, Yael Averbush is just brilliant. She's a fantastic leader and is largely to credit for how well run the NWSL Players Association is, how well positioned it is. And I've just been kind of advising her in that process, but really it's been her leadership and Brooke Elby, who used to be president and then transitioned into a co-executive director role. So, you know, one of the things we wanted to do is create a more formal line of communication. That was our really, truly, that was our focus. You know, we weren't looking to strain the league or burden the league's resources, because at that time, they didn't really have a functioning commissioner, and I'm sure we'll get into that, but, they had Amanda Duffy as, I think she was later named president. She did a great job, but, you know, in my view, you need a commissioner who's empowered to do some things in order to negotiate a CBA. And so, you know, we've kind of been wanting a commissioner to be named so we could create that better relationship between the Players Association and the league itself, to be able to communicate directly, get things done.
And when you say league, do you specifically mean the owners?
So, good question, actually. So there is a league office, and then there's the board of directors, which are the owners. And part of the challenge had been that they didn't really constitute the league office sufficiently to function in an effective way for a period of time. And part of that is also U.S. Soccer, which is playing the management role in the league. So it's complicated. Yeah. And that's part of the reason we didn't want to, like, you know, dive right into a CBA when I think we're all trying to figure out what the relationship is between these various actors. Mm-hmm. We did get a voluntary recognition agreement negotiated and signed and done. You know, it's a little bit of a process, but we're happy with where it landed. And, you know, Yael, Brooke, and I met with the board of directors in person in, I guess we're on the championship, which would have been October. I almost said January. That's how my time was since the timing is so off. I was like, what year is it? Yeah, and that was really, I mean, really productive. You know, there's a really, really strong sense of a shared vision and common goals. And so that's part of the reason we went about the relationship between labor and management differently. You know, I think for all the right reasons, in every other industry and sector, you'd sort of see workers organize, immediately turn around and want to get a CBA done, and those things govern the terms and conditions of employment. Here, we see ourselves as a partner. I think I've said that before on this podcast, and really and truly, not just in name, but in substance. And that's part of the reason I'm really fired up about Lisa Baird being named commissioner of the league, because I think, you know, she said in her statement today that she's been a fan of the league and the players. You know, she acknowledged us as being kind of what drives fan interest in the league, and I think I'm really excited about what that relationship can bring.
My understanding of what a CBA is, mm-hmm. is the relationship and the collectively bargained agreement between the association, the Players Association, and a league. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes, you know, Major League Baseball led to strikes. They've talked about the NBA, you know, we've had shortened seasons because of that. The NFL is currently going through that with an extended season potentially. Right. So you hadn't had that leverage or advantage yet in those conversations. And yet, just from last year when we spoke, we've seen some pretty significant progress made. So just some of the things that we had mentioned last year were things along the lines of being on, was it the Lifetime Network mm-hmm. that the games were on? But they were also at 1 o'clock in the mm-hmm. middle of the summer in Houston.
Right.
You know, you were seeing player safety literally put at you know, risk potentially. And then there was also the entire Sky Blue situation. Mm-hmm. Now, from everything I've seen, that's actually improved.
Significantly.
What do you contribute that to
without a CBA? Yeah, I love that question. I think it proves our point, right? I think this league is past the point of bare knuckle season to season, are we going to make it? And now I think we're seeing Budweiser come in, Anheuser-Busch. You see big time sponsors and big time players coming into the league, seeing not only that this is worth supporting, but there's a return on investment.
Yes.
And, you know, I think we're finally seeing some investors and sponsors who understand that this is a business, right? And that's what Asheville City, to bring it local, you know, we've seen it that way on the women's side from day one. I'm really, really pleased to see that. And I think, you know, you pointed out a CBA is a contract. And the threat of a strike is always the leverage that workers have. I'm not going to say, well, you know, we're taking that off the table forever and ever and ever. No lawyer worth their salt would ever say that, right? But I will say we're not, you know, that's not what we want. We want to play. You know, we want to promote the league. We want to get more games. We want more opportunity. We want more teams, more players getting involved in the game. And that's a reality of where we're at right now. And so I think, you know, us getting better organized was helpful to the board, to the league office, so that they can communicate with us about things like schedules and preseason report dates and et cetera, right? And so I think the owners, some of the decisions that have been made to increase minimum salaries and, you know, the moves you saw in the offseason as a result of that board of directors meeting back in October, I think it's a reciprocal move on their part to say, yeah, you know what, players, you are a partner in this, and we're going to take care of you, and we want to see this league thrive. And to do that, it's not just about you know, saving money where you can, it's also about investing money in the product. I mean, without the product, you got nothing.
Why haven't we been able to pick up a 10th, 11th, a 12th team quite
yet? Stay tuned. You asked me, what's off limits? Well, I can't, you know, I got some inside info.
All right.
Stay tuned.
You keep your secrets.
That's right. I keep
all right. Lightning round.
Okay.
Word association.
Oh, God. Nervous.
First couple words that just come to mind when I mention these names.
That's a scary thing.
You get one pass.
Okay.
So use it judiciously. Carlos Cordero.
Rapinoe.
Lydia Waukee.
I think, man, sustainability, longevity.
Hope Solo.
Oh, I worry about her. I don't know.
Bryson Lee.
Man, loyal, reliable.
Jeffrey Kessler.
I'm going to pass on that one because I just got nothing. I'm drawing a blank.
Jill Ellis.
Oh, God. One of the greats and truly, I mean, pioneer.
And Angela Huclis Mungano.
Smart as hell. Yeah.
And so very recently, USL named Angela, I think her actual title is strategic consultant or mm-hmm. top advisor.
Mm-hmm.
And basically what they have brought her in to do is help them blueprint or create a path potentially for, there was rumors of a mm-hmm. potentially a competing D1 league. I think they've kind of backed off that potentially and created almost a path to pro, to steal a motto from the USL League 2. And maybe they're looking more at D2 for women. If you were hired into that position, if you were consulting the consultant, what would you hope to see from her? What would you in that position create as your first two or three initiatives?
So let me say this. I mean, I think it's no secret. It's the Grant Wall article that came out that really kind of blew things up. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was a little unfair to USL, actually. It's not surprising. Anytime you're trying to do anything in the game, like, you know, NDAs and secrets only take you so far. I think word got out that they were looking at doing something in the women's game. Mm-hmm. And USL is a 70-person front office. You know, I mean, I think NWSL, last I checked, was three or four. So, you know, and there's been some hindrance as a result of that. Mm-hmm. We also know that there are a lot of women's teams that really, you know, you look at Portland, the teams that really succeed have an infrastructure on the men's side also. And there's some efficiencies, some economies of scale, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it was a little unfair to USL because they were, I think, in the brainstorming phase. And that article just, you know, it was really unfortunate. It's like blew up kind of what they're trying to do. And I think it was unbelievably savvy on their part to bring in Angela Huclies so that they could take themselves out of the, okay, like, look, what we're doing is we're starting from scratch. We're starting from zero. We want to make moves. We've got the ability to make moves in the women's game. But we need someone who knows better than, you know, all due respect to USL, there are a bunch of men in that office and running that league. Let's bring in someone like Angela Huclies, who, aside from being a gold medalist and, you know, one of the greats in the game, but also just unbelievably smart. She's an entrepreneur, very, very savvy. Let's bring her in and let's ask her to just do some digging, investigate. What should we do? If I were advising USL, I would have told them to do that. I would have put Angela Huclies on my shortlist, and I would have told Angela Huclies, go talk to people. Go dig into what's happening across the country. And that's exactly what she's doing. She's listening. She's not coming into this. I'm sure she's got her ideas. I'm sure USL does. But I truly believe she's coming into this, first of all, with a pure heart. You know, she wants the women's game. She's a gold medalist on the U.S. Women's National Team. Tell me a better candidate to tell you what should happen in the American women's game. And I think she's also, because she's smart, approaching it from an evidence-based perspective. You know, what are the facts? And then let's let that evidence inform what our conclusions should be rather than the other way around.
One of my biggest frustrations with the Federation, and we're going to get to some of them here in a bit, if we're talking just about league structure, and I think this is something that 25 years ago, even, you know, 10 years ago, it's 2020 now, so even 10 years ago, when they set out these professional league standards of this is the certain financial bars, these are the things that clubs and ownerships have to hit to create a sustainable, you know, infrastructure within this country to blah, 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 blah. All of their, what I, in my consideration, are very subjective melting pot ideas of, well, this is what the NBA does. This is what, you know, women are successful here. So we'll do this. For D1, for the NWSL, the professional league standards say, A, that you're supposed to have, as long as the league's been around, you're supposed to have 10 teams by now, and there is what there is there.
Right.
But that 75% of the teams have to play in metropolitan areas of 750,000 people. Stadiums have to sit 5,000, and you have to have a principal owner that owns 35% of the team and is worth $15 million. That's kind of comparable to what you see in the men's side. The numbers are a little bit higher, but it's comparable. At the D2 and D3 for the men, obviously, you know, when I talk to Ryan and Alan and Jimmy with Asheville City, and they have professional ambitions at the D3 level, there's certain pars and barriers that they have to hit. But even for the D2 level for the women, you're looking at six teams for the first year in a league. You're looking at 51, a majority percent of them, having to play in metropolitan areas of 500,000 or plus. Stadiums only have to sit 2,000, but you still have to have a principal owner worth $7.5 million, again, with 35% ownership. Do you think this is a positive thing to create that stability and to perpetuate momentum toward a league that if it gets sit, you're not going to see teams shuffling in and out? Or do you think these are barriers for what could be the kind of hidden pockets of women's soccer?
Love that question so much. Tim for U.S. as a president. So,
bumper stickers are being made.
I'll run your campaign. Well, so, okay, there's a lot in there, and I'll just sort of start spitballing and we can go back and forth. So we're not going to get leadership from U.S. soccer on this issue, right? Like, I'll just start there. That's what they're supposed to do. That's what they should do. And, you know, I've been involved with FIFPro, the World Players Union. And one of the things that we talked about at the first convention or conference that they had to bring all the various players associations across the world together. And I was there on behalf of NWSL. Their thought is, look, we need pressure to come from FIFA, but we need federations to put pressure on FIFA. Right. And I'm sure we'll get an equal pay dispute at some point. There's a connector to that, too. But we really, you know, in an ideal world. And I think Carlos Cadero, you know, it kind of chaps my, I don't know if kids are listening. I'm getting better about that.
In. Yeah. It's all right.
You know, how do you mispronounce Megan Rapinoe's? I'm sorry, but just like, really, like, if you, are you hiding under a rock? Like, and I'm sure he regrets that deeply. And anyway, but we're not going to get leadership from them on this. And so it's kind of funny to like, you've got these these requirements without the leadership or the, I mean, and let me say this, U.S. soccer has invested something like north of $1 million a year in NWSL. So they're to be, I don't want to be too critical. We want that. We need that, you know? The NWSL is postured a little differently vis-a-vis the federation than the U.S. women's national team players are. But that being said, so I think it's part of the conversation I'm interested in. I think Asheville City proves the premise of those minimum requirements wrong. Right? I mean, look, our soccer IQ in this town is off the charts. Our attendance relative to our size, off the charts. We were outpacing Sky Blue. And I'm sure I'll come back to that too. In attendance on the women's side. You know, our environment, our atmosphere. I can say this because I'm an advocate in the LGBTQ community. I feel like the Memorial Stadium, it's like, you know, it's like a drag queen that's been partying too many nights in a row and just needs to like take a nap, take a shower, get your makeup straight, and like let's come back and do another show, you know. But that's our stadium, you know. It might be a shithole, but it's our shithole. You know, there's a lot that I think we need to improve on that we can do better at Asheville City, but I think there's a lot we do right, and a lot of that is like, I mean, you guys, it's the fans, man. I mean, that's what it's about. You got to create a fan culture, and South Slope Blues have done that, you know. And you need people who are genuine about it and earnest about it. To me, those are the things that are more important than, I mean, stadium size is important, right? But like population size, I don't care how big your city is. I care how many butts are in seats.
In your opinion, does that have more to do with sponsors and the marketing potential?
No question, right? I mean, it's having a national footprint is really important. But that's not to say that you have to be in, you know, downtown Chicago. You know, Asheville, Portland, Seattle, there's some cool cities. You know, my hometown, St. Louis. You've got mid-sized cities that I think could thrive really well. You got Chattanooga. You got, I mean, you know, Ventura County. I mean, you could go across the country and find pockets that are maybe in close proximity to some bigger cities, and you want some bigger cities in there. But really, the question is, can they turn out fans? That's the question, not how big your town is.
Yeah.
And sponsors want to, I mean, look, people in Boone, North Carolina, and Madison County, North Carolina, they buy stuff too, right? So to me, the point to sponsors should be like, what is the, how many eyeballs are on your product? And not to say I would rule out New York, Chicago, San Francisco, DC, those kind of towns, Dallas, you know, that have soccer, really active soccer communities. But to me, the question is like, in these communities where we're looking at the game, are people coming out to support it? And not just the youth level, but we're talking about the pro level, yeah. Right? Because sometimes there's a disconnect between, that's the thing I see and feel fairly strongly about is like, great, you got a lot of people playing soccer when they're 10. Are they following soccer when they're 30?
The Asheville City women play in the WPSL.
Uh-huh.
And there is a comparable league. It plays nationally, but for whatever reason, it just hasn't found a footprint in the Southeast, the United Women's Soccer League. Mm-hmm. And they have recently announced that they have a UWS 2, which seems a little confusing because it's basically what they described as a reserve league. It's for U23s. And it basically, the way they're promoting is that it's a testing ground for expansion clubs and clubs who want a larger player pool to pull from that they can. Again, this is kind of weird because this is the de facto D2 at the moment. Right. And you're basically giving like an amateur club to an amateur club, a reserve team to an amateur team.
Right.
What do you see as the advantage of that as opposed to potentially what Asheville City's doing with their academy system, which kind of functions the same, but with the sole purpose of kind of breaking that pay-to-play model?
Right. So, first of all, I think UWS is doing really good stuff. You know, I think if they had more of a presence in our region, it would be more of a serious conversation for us if that's a place we'd want to be. You know, Joe Farrar, the guy that runs it, has big ideas, and, you know, I commend him for what he's doing. I kind of wish they would look at Pro Rel, right? Like, what an exciting model that would be.
And let women figure that out first. Like, they usually do all good things in society.
I'm just saying. It wouldn't be a bad idea. You know, Joe, I hope he's listening, and he's like, I'm going to write that one down. I think, you know, to your point, this is where the vacuum of leadership from U.S. soccer really hurts, because how many spaces can we occupy that are in the same lane? And, you know, we need some variety here. It's not to say that, you know, we don't need two of the same thing really anywhere. It would be nice if there was more cohesion, more clarity around the investment, right? Like, to what you just asked, like Asheville City, we really see the pay-to-play model being part and parcel of the root of the problem. And so I feel really good about what we're doing with Just Play and the Academy. I'm a little concerned about, you know, this thing. It's like, it's hard to understand what it is and what purpose it's going to serve. I think time will tell. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't really understand it. Our Academy is effectively a reserve squad, and we've had Academy kids play for us. You know, we've identified some really bright and promising young players through the Academy, you know, and I feel pretty strongly that we have to tackle pay to play if we want to change the game.
Building off of that, as one of the things that we saw at the World Cup this past summer, we're seeing it with the Women's League in England and across Europe, you know, even countries in Asia, you know, at least they're still sending women's teams, you know,
to
the World Cup. But we talked about last summer where, you know, the world is caught up, and the world hasn't caught up. It's
setting the
Sam
standard.
Sam Kerr is now no longer playing in America.
Right.
She is going to Europe. Where is the hidden advantage? Where is the leverage left that we have to exploit to continue to be torchbearers in the women's game?
Well, we've won 4 World Cups. That's a pretty good starting point, right? We do. We still win. You know, I think, you know, you made the point. We got 9 teams at NWSL. We got to grow. We need more teams. And I think we have a much, while other countries are setting the standard in some respects, we still are a broader talent pool, right? I mean, look at goalkeepers. I'm a goalkeeper, so, you know, it's easy for me to pick on this, but like, there's so much hype on Hope Solo, but I mean, I could tell you right now, easily 10, 12 goalkeepers. I mean, it's, you know, fractions of difference in certain aspects of their game, but it's not like Hope Solo was really far and away from the people underneath her. So, you know, I think that's where we have leverage. And I think looking at broadening NWSL and also creating this D2 league is precisely where we can lead the way. I'm really interested in D2 on the women's side. Very interested. You know, I think Pro Rel from NWSL to D2 is probably still a ways off. But that's where I think what UWS is doing is interesting, because there's some control you have over your own league to create these mini kind of Pro Rel situations.
An open system within a closed system.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. That's a great way to put it. Yeah. You know, and maybe those are some creative things that UWS is looking at, or I don't know what Angela Heuclis is thinking, but maybe that's something she's looking at, you know? So, I mean, it's funny, because on the one hand, it's easy to be so critical of the Federation. It's easy to be critical of where we are. We want to see things better. We're also in the petri dish, you know, and I think there's a lot of experimentation happening that is going to lead to evidence-based, like, sound results in the future. And it's really exciting to be part of it.
You touched on it a little bit earlier, and we won a World Cup. Go us. There was this shadow over the entire summer, and it continues to cast.
The shadow of inequality, strangely, does not just disappear when you win.
With victories.
That's
exactly.
Right.
Let's back up just a little bit and do a quick little timeline to get us to where we are, because there's not many things that happen. Well, actually, this is a complete lie, because there's plenty that happens late at night that keeps me up at 1 o'clock in the morning.
I know all about that.
Reading about the most ridiculous stuff in the world. And the other day, a massive, whether it was through Discovery or the EEOC, briefly came out and got dumped. And I found myself at 1 o'clock in the morning on my phone reading PDFs that I didn't need to be reading.
I love that. You need to call me at like 1 a.m. You can hold a baby and drink a beer while you're doing that.
But so let's go all the way back to March 2016, when five U.S. women's national players filed an EEOC complaint. Fast forward to the next spring, and the U.S. women's national team signed a five-year CBA. February 2019, the EEOC grants a right to sue. March 2019, they gain the ability to be considered a class action, and 50 different past and present U.S. women's national players joined the lawsuit. July 2019, we win a fourth World Cup. And then in August 2019, mediation occurred and a court date of May 5th, 2020.
What's the set. Air quotes on radio for mediation? How do we convey that?
It lasted 1 week. So again, there was this massive brief that got out. And my interpretation of this was, you know, up to this point, it was depositions and what evidence everybody's bringing to the table for this court. And this specific sentence or pair of sentences really caught my attention. It was the way that USSF attempted to explain their stance in this defense in this lawsuit, that having made all these choices in contract negotiations, the plaintiffs, the U.S. women's national team players, cannot plausibly contend that their compensation arrangement reflects sex discrimination rather than the result of compromises made during collective bargaining. What does that mean to the layman? what leg are they attempting to stand on in this?
In a sentence, what they're saying is you got the deal you bargained for. That would sort of be like, I do criminal defense work, so it's sort of like a bank robber holding a gun to a teller's head and her handing the money over and then saying, well, you got the deal you bargained for, right? And maybe that's a little violent, a little extreme, but it's not a choice. The key word is choices, right? Like, it's not a choice if you have no ability to bargain over it or negotiate it. And one of the key arguments in favor of the U.S. women's national team, those players that you've had, there are 28 named plaintiffs, and then they've been certified as a class. And I think the time it's dating, but every player who was under contract dating back to, like, I want to say it was 2015, I think, like June 15 or 16 in my memory. Again, timeline. You know, you can't violate federal law. That's the key. You cannot be sexist or racist in your negotiation. I'm not saying USA soccer. That's a little inflammatory, I understand, but certainly sexism is at the root of this. And Title VII prohibits discrimination on the basis of sex. And, you know, the analogy that the lawyers for the U.S. women's national players have used, that I like this. I hadn't thought of it. And when I heard it, I was like, right, that just makes sense. It's sort of like wrestlers in different weight classes, right? You've got, I don't know the categories, how you describe them, but let's say you got a wrestler who's 100 to 115 pounds, but then you got a wrestler who's like 185 to 200 pounds, and they're representing their country at an international competition. You're not paying the lighter weight guy less because he's lighter. You're paying them the same because they're representing their country. And so that's the gist of the argument in favor of the U.S. women.
And from what I understand, part of what the U.S. Women's National Team's counsel is saying is that even if a union agreed to sub-minimum wage wages, that doesn't make it legally possible.
Correct. And you can cite to a ton of analysis. You know, you could, let's say the union had no ability to negotiate the contract in such a way that children under the age of 15 wouldn't be paid for, you know, their services. Again, a violation of federal law, it would be laughable if anyone tried to defend that. And so that's, you know, I understand what U.S. soccer, I do as a lawyer, their lawyers are doing what they're supposed to do. They're raising these arguments. These are interesting questions. You know, there are very few places where in the employment context, take away from sports, but just the employment, broader employment context, because this is what a judge is going to be thinking about. Whatever this judge decides, however this case goes, it's going to govern these issues in other employment contexts.
And judges hate to set precedent.
Right. They want to be really careful to keep it in the middle of the road. They don't want to get too far ahead, you know, as my law partner likes to say, too far out over their skis. And, you know, the phrase that comes to mind is unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, in this context, this is one of the few scenarios where men and women are segregated in the performance of their duties, right? Like, we don't have female pilots and male pilots. Now, there's reasons for that, and those are fun questions to debate and discuss. But the fact of the matter is that there is a women's side to the Olympics, to the World Cup. There is a men's side to the Olympics, the World Cup, et cetera, et cetera. But the common denominator is that they're representing their country. They're doing the same job. And so that distinction, it's not, you know, it is what U.S. soccer is kind of fixated on, but that's why I like the weight class example, because it's like, they're both wrestling, right? Granted, like, the match may appear different based on size. There may be different, you know, maybe some fans are more interested in the heavier guys wrestling or whatever. I don't know. I'm not a wrestling fan, but I'm sure there are people who have their wrestler in, you know, in the lighter weight or heavier weight categories. Same is true in the men's and women's side. You know, we have people who are more drawn to the women's game. We have people who are more drawn to the men's game. And that's where things get really fun, because women are making more money than the men.
That's interesting, because you've seen this debate argued mostly on Twitter, which is just a toxic place to have civil conversation. But the sentiment that I kept seeing over and over last summer was this confluence, basically, of the, if I'm interpreting this correctly, the difference between what the women's players and the men's player, who, you know, they actually, the U.S. men's national players, have come out with a strong statement of support of the women's players this week. But there was this, what I took as a confusion between what the initial lawsuit was saying, which is, as representatives of the country, our own federation owe us this, and the debate that a lot of confused men out there seem to be fighting, that were basically saying that, you know, we'll take, for example, France in 2018, when the men won their World Cup, the French men, the French Federation, took home $38 million out of a potential $400 million that was separated out between the participants. Whereas in 2019, $4 million went to the U.S. women's national teams out of a total pot of $30 million. So what...
Ugh, I love that.
why, if you hear that, you're automatically going to say, well, there's not as many eyes. It's something like 3.5 billion people watch the Men's World Cup, but only 786 million watch the Women's World Cup. Hear these kind of like largely skewed numbers, and then... Men make the assumption, well, you need to generate as much money to earn as much money. Why is that such a fallacy?
So a few reasons. So first of all, we need to separate out commercial revenue from revenue generated by things like, you know, ticket sales. You know, those are two totally different categories, and especially when you got Soccer United marketing lurking in the background, we won't get into that right now, but, you know, you have to separate those two things out. That's the first thing. The second thing, when U.S. soccer makes that argument, that's a you problem. That's a U.S. soccer problem. That's not a me problem. It's sort of like, think about it this way. Think of a company that sells widgets, right? And they've got male, let's say, you know, obviously I live in a world that's a little more complicated than male and female, but let's just, for the sake of argument, you know, you've got people who identify as male purchasing your widgets, and you've got people who identify as female purchasing your widgets. Do you pay your female employees less because, you know, you've made that distinction? No, you don't, for a million reasons. We're a long way away from it, but if the U.S. men were to ever win the World Cup, and they get their, you know, 30, by then it'll be probably a lot more than what it is now. Or what is it? 33 million, I think. You know where that money goes? It doesn't go to the men. It goes to the Federation. The men only take home a small portion of that. So that's a myth. These numbers, it goes to the Federation. And that's kind of my point, is that what's coming into the Federation's coffers, whether it's from the World Cup, from FIFA, from wherever it's from, they can't distinguish on the basis of sex with respect to how they pay their employees. And that's the problem. We also know, I'm just going to throw this out there just for superfluous fun, just use a... So, you know, we know that the U.S. Soccer Federation has not put the same level investment in marketing and promoting the women as they have the men. And despite that, not because of that, despite that, with their both hands tied behind their backs, they have produced more revenue for U.S. soccer than the men by a lot. Like, it's not even a little bit. And yet they still pay them less. I heard, I was listening to something the other day where if both the men and the women played 20 friendlies.
20 friendlies, yep.
Right? That the women would make, I think it was 36% less than the men.
Yes. And that doesn't matter if they won them all, lost them all.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right. You know, and look, not to diss our men, but, you know, you got to wonder what would happen if you maybe made some incentives for winning.
And is that collectively bargained also?
So each, the players association on each side is negotiate. They have CBAs. And the men are actually actively involved in a CBA negotiation. So I have some questions over the timing of their announcement and what they said. I think it's strategic on their part. It would have been nice to hear from them sooner if they meant it.
Well, Megan, last question. What's what's on the docket for the Asheville City Women this summer?
Oh, man. Player announcements just started coming out, so I realized, like, oh, I can't talk about I'm really fired up about who we've sent. We're looking strong. You know, Carolyn Warheftig is kind of joining Stacy as co-head coach. I feel like, you know, we're just thrilled about that. We learned a lot last year. We're really disappointed, frankly, despite ending better than we would have thought, you know.
And a 91st minute hat trick.
It still hurts.
Header.
It still hurts. I just can't. I mean, look, we've made no secret. Our ambition every year is to win the WPSL, period. No excuses. And anything short of that is a disappointment. We feel that we owe it to our fans to do that, to be clear that our goal is to bring home the WPSL title every single year. And we've not done that. So we've fallen short. You know, what we really, I think what separates us more than anything is our environment, our fans, the atmosphere we create on game day. Not we as in, like, you know, our interns and volunteers and folks who are out there putting up field boards and working hard to create the stadium, but we as in the fans who bring the drums, the chants, the smoke bombs. As you know, you're not going to see that anywhere else in our league. We've got, I think, a really dynamic and exciting roster to kind of match the excitement and enthusiasm that our fans bring. You know, I'd like to see, I don't know, I'd love to, we've got a couple doubleheaders this summer. You know, we've got doubleheader on Pride. Our season opener is a doubleheader. We're trying something a little different this year. And I really, really hope that people see it as a big party. You know, they want to come out and spend their whole afternoon, their whole evening there. I've got three little kids, so I totally get it when it's hard, you know. But truth be told, I mean, even for the families, it is a raucous, fun time, even for the kids. You know, when Calvin, the very, very first ever Asheville City game, the men's home opener, I'll never forget it because it was cold and rainy. You remember, it was terrible. So cold.
We marched all the way up from Big Top, and my wife almost was like, we're not doing
what are we doing? Yes. And that place was just, I mean, it was so fun. Calvin wore his jammies because he was like, and he wouldn't put a winter coat on. I'm like, it's May, but it's like, you need your winter coat. I could not get him to leave. And it was 10 o'clock. And I was like, all right, dude, we really, like, for real. He's like, no, I'm not leaving. I mean, you know, that's what I'm hoping to create with our home games is fans for life. And, you know, I think we've put together a team on the women's side and on the men's side, frankly, that's going to create that.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Megan. And we're going to catch up later this season.
Yes. Awesome. Thanks, Tim.
I guess that's why they call us the Blues. Time on our hands could be time spent with brews. Drinking like tourists, yelling like drunkards, scoring some stunners. We'll win you over. And I guess that's why they call us the Blues.
You've been listening to the You're Smarter Than Us podcast. Shoot us an email at youresmarterthanus@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at YOURE_smarter.